On the eve of his 52nd birthday, February 11, 1861, the president-elect of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, walked onto a train, the first step of his journey to the White House and his rendezvous with destiny. But as the train began to carry Lincoln toward Washington, it was far from certain what he would find there. Bankrupt and rudderless, the government was on the verge of collapse. To make matters worse, reliable intelligence confirmed a conspiracy to assassinate him as he passed through Baltimore. It is no exaggeration to say that the fate of the Republic hung in the balance. How did Lincoln survive this grueling odyssey to become the president we know from the history books? The new book, Lincoln on the Verge, tells the story of a leader discovering his own strength, improvising brilliantly, and seeing his country up close during these pivotal 13 days. Ted Widmer is distinguished lecturer at Macaulay Honors College, CUNY. In addition to his teaching, he writes actively about American history for the New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Washington Post. Again, the new book is Lincoln on the Verge, 13 Days to Washington, and it's a pleasure to welcome Ted Widmer to the roundtable this morning. Ted, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. Really happy to be here.
You know, so two things I think the listeners should know. One is that this is a very big book, but two is that it basically, as the subtitle suggests, is tackling 13 days. I'm curious as to what brought you to want to write about Lincoln, first of all, and second of all, this particular time in his life.
I loved Lincoln as a young boy. I read old 1940s and 50s children's books about him that were lying around the house, and I was fascinated by him, including the way he looks. I was always sort of drawn into his unusual features, and even as a kid, you could tell there was some sadness in there. I was intimidated about writing a book about him. There have been so many great ones, but I thought there was a new way of getting at the story, and I kind of stumbled across the story of this train trip, and I also liked trains when I was a kid. And as I read more and more about it, I thought these are 13 incredible days that are changing the life of Lincoln and of the nation. And there's a lot of tension building because he's figuring out that there's a plot to kill him. And as he goes through Baltimore on his way to Washington, he's got to obviously avoid the killers, but also calm things down at a time when the country was very divided the way it is now. And he did it. He magically did all of those things. And I thought, what a great kind of a historical thriller.
So the idea of Abraham Lincoln walking onto this train, he's the president-elect, and it's his first step of his journey to the White House. And when does this story start to, for you, start to compel you in the sense of, as a historian, of saying, okay, there's really something here?
Well, the very first minute of the trip is incredible because he spontaneously, well, we believe it was spontaneous, gave a farewell speech, a very short, it was probably 1 minute long speech to the people he'd lived among in Springfield. And that speech really changed the atmosphere in the United States. As simple as it was, he talked about his sadness at leaving his hometown, what it had meant to live among his neighbors, leaving a town where he'd raised his children and had buried one child, and the heaviness of the burden on him. And it was a very human speech. And before that time, Lincoln had been a kind of strange and unfamiliar president-elect who won a very small percentage of the vote. And with that speech, he kind of humanized himself and related to a lot of Americans who had not voted for him and improved his chances of making it on this journey.
One of the things that you point out in the book is that just to become president was a grueling journey and odyssey that many of us have read a lot about. But this book tells the story of his discovery of really seeing the country up close in this 13 days and learning a lot about the land that he is about to preside over as president.
Right. That, for me, is when the book got deeper and better. For a few years, I was just writing a book about Lincoln on a train. And then it occurred to me, I ought to try to describe what he can see out the window of the train. And he's moving through a very interesting landscape, crowded cities and Western landscapes, crossing rivers, going alongside the Great Lakes, increasingly coming through a Southern landscape as he gets close to D.C. And I read a lot of small town newspapers to get at what's going on in each little town, basically, that he's going through. And they all were in a moment of profound change. It wasn't just that they'd elected the first Republican president and people felt a war was coming, but there were huge economic changes coming. The train had changed a lot of the North, not so much the South. Oil had just been discovered in Pennsylvania. And things are just really unsettled. And I wanted to get Lincoln's perspective on all of that. And so I read that there are a lot of train guides from the 1850s and 60s. And I read a lot of those to get at what it looked like to a traveler looking out the window. And I think that made it a better book.
Another thing that is fascinating about this that you point out is that he's speaking constantly, isn't he? I mean, there's no leisure in this trip. He's pretty much working from start to finish.
Completely. One of the tensions is how hard it was even among friendly people. I mean, he's worried about the unfriendly people, but even the friendly people are coming out in huge numbers. He often can't get through a crowd. And in a couple cases, it was dangerous. He was nearly crushed by friendly crowds, and they always are demanding speeches. And he's very well organized, and he's written out maybe one or two speeches a day back in Illinois before the trip starts. But then when the train starts moving, he has to go out there and give a speech every few miles. And so he instantly goes past the speeches he's written, and he's just improvising out there. And one of the successes of his journey is how well he did that. He starts giving really profound speeches near the end of the trip. And so it's a beautiful thing to see him growing on the journey.
You write about I'm interested in this because we're talking to you from Albany, New York, and the special made a stop in Albany. And you write, Albany's ambitious politicians must have viewed Lincoln with wariness as he came into view, and doubtless the opposite was also true. Even then,
right,
New York's government was famous for its infighting, and he would have to step carefully, avoiding promises to job seekers and other encumbrances as he continued to wear down from the trip. Lincoln needed to get through the evening with as little damage as possible. How did he do?
Not great. They had a bad night in Albany. It's a little unclear what exactly happened, but it was the farthest east they had come on the journey. They reached the Hudson River, of course. And I think Easterners looked down on the Lincolns as uncouth Westerners, and Lincoln could probably handle that pretty well. But his wife was sensitive, and she was socially ambitious. And it sounds to me like someone said something that ticked her off, and they went to bed angry and were pretty happy to get out of town the next morning. In spite of that, New York State is an incredibly important state for Lincoln, where he's got to make nice with the governor and with the legislature because he desperately needs help from every state, and New York State is the most populous state in the country by far. And it's not just that he needs the support of politicians in Congress, but he even then is thinking, if we need to call up troops, I'm going to need every governor for help doing that, because there was no national draft in 1861. So he's annoyed in Albany, but he can't get that annoyed because he needs New York desperately.
You write in that section, Lincoln's haggard appearance troubled bystanders. A young observer thought that the man upon whom all hopes rested looked, quote, much wearied and careworn. A Democratic paper thought he, quote, does not look as if he had the bodily vigor to stand the pressure upon him, end quote. It also blamed him for the behavior of the crowd as, quote, rude hands jostled him and his underlings commanded him, and all about him the struggle was who was to control him. Some in the crowd had vented darker feelings. One man said audibly that Negro lover will never get to the executive mansion. Immediately, a big burly fellow nearby came over and punched him in the face. One of the two things, I mean, there is that which is striking, but of course there's stories like this along the way, along this entire trip.
Right. The country was badly divided, and it would be way too simple to say North versus South. In every state, there were deep divisions of many kinds. I mean, there are a lot of political parties floating around. The Republicans are still a very new party, and the Democrats are in a kind of slow motion implosion. They sometimes act like they're one party, but they're falling apart. They're now a kind of northern and southern version of the Democratic Party, and there are a couple new parties out there trying to get a foothold. And in every city, there are people who are pretty sympathetic to the South and pretty hostile to the idea of a brand new party calling themselves the Republicans, with this unknown guy with very few qualifications daring to become the president. And so it was hardly a journey of celebration through the North. Every few miles, there was another challenge. And in New York City, which we think of as an extremely northern city, there was a lot of feeling for the South, and he had a hard time in New York City also.
That's right, and so he has a tough time. And is it he who resolves never to return to Albany?
That was overheard. Someone was overheard saying that. It sounds more like Mary Todd Lincoln to me than I think Lincoln would not have said that. And among other things, Lincoln needs the great political boss of New York State, who is not the governor, but he's the kind of wire puller, and that's Thurlow Weed, who was the mentor of William Seward, who's a former governor of New York and is the senator. And he will become a very close ally of Lincoln's and is, you know, an important man at this time. So even though they had a rough night in Albany, and I forgot to mention John Wilkes Booth is playing in a play in Albany that same night.
Right.
He was probably going to be coming back to Albany, although he didn't until his funeral train came through 4 years later.
The name of the book is Lincoln on the Verge, 13 Days to Washington. Ted Widmer is the author and our guest this morning. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. The point I wanted to make, though, is that you have this tough time in Albany, and yes, it's tough, but your next stop is New York City, which is really the big deal of how you were greeted there.
Yeah. And he had a mixed response. He did pretty well with the crowds in the streets, and there was a huge, you know, the equivalent of a ticker tape parade. I don't think there was actual ticker tape. That's usually more closer to Wall Street, but huge crowds. It was estimated a 250,000 people, you know, an immense crowd. That would be a very big crowd today too. Lining the streets as he came in a train station near where Penn Station is today, but it was a few blocks west. And then got over to Broadway and went way downtown to a hotel that was a famous hotel then called the Astor House. And it was right next to City Hall, pretty close to a few blocks above Trinity Church. And huge crowds all along the way and people seeing Lincoln and cheering for him, and a pretty healthy response. But then he had to meet the mayor of New York City, who's a very slippery character named Fernando Wood, who's trying to have it all ways. He's very close to Southerners. He's thinking about running for higher office himself. He floats the idea of New York City becoming an independent kind of republic that's on equal terms with the North and the South. And nobody really wants that, except Fernando Wood. But that's not going to fly, and Lincoln doesn't like that idea. So, and he's got to deal with some Wall Street very, very wealthy people, and that does not go very well. Lincoln is never very good at talking about money, but he is good at talking about saving the Union and patriotism and memories of the American Revolution and memories of George Washington. And the first president is George Washington, and he's inaugurated in New York. And Lincoln is good at hearing those historical echoes and reminding Americans that there were once very powerful feelings that united them.
In some ways, I think, Ted, we think of these, I mean, it, given our contemporary politics, I read about in your book about this 13-day journey, and you think of, okay, well, what is this meant to accomplish? I mean, obviously, it's from to get to one place to the other. But what was the overall goal and the setting out of saying, if there was such a thing as political strategists saying, okay, Mr. President-elect, here's what you need to accomplish?
You know, I'm not even sure he had a strategy. I mean, he had certain things. He had an inaugural address in his pocket that he was working on throughout the trip. And so that is a strategic plan saying what his policies will be. But I don't know how much of a day-to-day strategy he had for these 13 days, because the pressure just was tremendous. And he had to improvise a lot in his speeches. And then he's hearing every day more and more threats about to his person as he's going to get close to Washington. So the first strategy is just to survive the journey, and he does that barely. But then I think another one is to just bring in Americans, calm things down. He is saying over and over again that he will not tamper with slavery where it already exists. So he's no abolitionist in 1861. He's saying slavery is fine in the South, and we won't touch it. But he's also saying he will not allow it to expand into the West, where the South has many times promised they wouldn't want it to go in previous compromises. But then they tear up the paper and they kept saying, oh, we changed our mind, we want it again. And Lincoln says, you can't do that. We made a compromise. You have to stick to it. And the South has gotten so crazy by this time that even him saying you made an earlier promise and you have to stick to it, that enrages them. So that is what causes the war to start.
As you mentioned, he is working on his inaugural address. Do we know what that process was like and how much, if any, time was spent on it during the journey?
We know a fair amount about that. He is writing it in Springfield, and he even has a couple drafts of it set in type so he can read it better. And then Lincoln is a very meticulous craftsman when it comes to writing an important formal speech, and he does many drafts of it, and a little bit unusual to set it into type, so it looks already like a printed book, a printed object. And he's talking with his advisors on the trip, and they are adding a few words and deleting some, and there are crucial adjustments. And one advisor, a guy named Orville Browning, tells him that it's really important to say he wants to hold on to a federal fort in South Carolina rather than retake it, because retake it sounds like an invasion. And the South Carolinians are so sensitive that if you say we just want to hold on to what we already had, that's a much better way of saying it than to say we are going to reclaim this thing that used to belong to us. And then William Seward, who I mentioned earlier, the great senator from Auburn, New York, he helps him hugely. They co-write the final paragraph, the beautiful paragraph about our better angels, which is one of the most famous things Lincoln ever wrote. It's actually co-written by Seward and Lincoln, and there isn't a whole lot of co-writing with Abraham Lincoln. He did it almost all himself, but the most important paragraph of one of his most important speeches was co-written by William Henry Seward.
I know this is getting a little bit off the subject, although you do address it in the book, but the difference between that first inaugural address and the second.
Well, they're both incredible speeches, but the second one, I think, is the greatest speech in American history, and people love to argue this from their armchairs, but Gettysburg Address is probably more famous, and there are great speeches by other presidents, but it is an extraordinary speech about humility and forgiveness, and we don't get a lot of either of those things in our politics. Our politics are pretty angry. They definitely are right now, and they have been for a lot of our history, and Lincoln is at the end of the most violent and lethal conflict in American history. He's saying, not only do we forgive you and we want you to come back and be our fellow Americans again, but we all owe we all need to ask for forgiveness from God. And he says that in a very profound way. And it's all the more striking because Lincoln is an unusual religious. He doesn't go to church very much. By the standards of his day, he was pretty unreligious, you know, just in outward signs. But he was a deep spiritual thinker in his own way. And he says we all have to ask for forgiveness for the curse, the sin of what he calls American slavery. So he doesn't say Southern slavery. He says American slavery. And I think that's a better way of saying it. So he's asking for forgiveness for the North as well as for the South.
We talked about this earlier in the program, but to make matters worse, there are reliable intelligence information coming in that confirms a conspiracy to assassinate Lincoln as he passes through Baltimore. When does he, Abraham Lincoln, become aware of that?
That is a point that is debated a little bit, but I believe, and I feel I have it on good authority, that he gets the first serious warning the night before the trip starts from a railroad detective, Alan Pinkerton, who later becomes famous, sort of starting the right. what will become the U.S. Secret Service. But he's a railroad detective, and he's been hired by a railroad president to penetrate a group of men in Baltimore who are loudly threatening Lincoln, and he finds out that it's absolutely true. And the information gets more and more reliable about where they're going to do it, how many men are involved. And he gets then even stronger warnings when he gets to New York City. And then a night later when he gets to Philadelphia, he hears it all. Two different people from two different police investigations come find him in his hotel room in Philadelphia and tell him you just cannot go through Baltimore unless you go through in the middle of the night in disguise or incognito, not in disguise. And that's what he does.
How does it affect him? I want to say mentally, but how does it affect his mood and ultimately, I mean, this is the greeting that he gets of going into the city that will become his base.
Yeah. Well, there are signs always that he is looking deeply sad, not a little bit sad, but there's like a profound melancholy inside of Abraham Lincoln that everyone noticed, his friends as well as strangers. It's like his face would drop and he would look unbelievably sad, and then he would snap out of it and come back to normal. And I feel like that's getting close to what we might call bipolar behavior, although I don't want to say that I know he was bipolar because I don't. But he never gave up. He never stopped with just sort of the core perseverance that defined Abraham Lincoln. And even in the face of these threats getting very serious at the end of the trip, he never wavered for a second and said, okay, I'm going to go in. And he goes in with a tiny group of people, two men and a woman sitting in an ordinary passenger car on the last train going from Philadelphia through Baltimore to Washington, an overnight train. And, you know, he never wavers at all and accepts his duty. And we always will have sadness in knowing what happened to Lincoln on April 14th, 1865. But I felt in doing this research and writing the book that I was grateful in a way that I hadn't been before for the fact that he got to be president at all. We got 4 years of Lincoln, and those 4 years saved our country. So I feel sadness at his assassination, but I also felt gratitude that he made it on this trip.
My final question to you is, what does it say about Lincoln when we talk about legacy? What does it say about Lincoln that you, such an accomplished historian, that you can take, and again, so much has been written about this man, that you can take just 13 days of his life and write 500 pages about it?
Yeah. Well, there's something about Lincoln that pulls you into his gravity. There's a great power inside of him. And part of it is physical, his strength. I kept reading about what he had to endure to get through a crowd and the many times he had to stand up and give speeches, and how often he said just the right thing. Not every time he made mistakes, but often. So he's an impressive physical specimen, but even more is the moral groundedness of this man, who could easily have gone off the rails at any moment. I didn't even mean that as a joke,
right.
But he never does. He's generous to his enemies. He wants to be a president for all Americans, even those who disagree with him. He's always removing himself from the equation, and he's saying, look, I'm just going to try to keep this great experiment of the United States of America going for a few more years, and then I won't be president anymore. And we've never really had a president before or since who had such a pitch-perfect sense of ethics, I would say, of the right thing to do, the right moral action. And we teach that to our children, and we try to act that way in our small, you know, in our neighborhoods or in our churches or in our school groups, respect other people. But he really lived a life like that, a pretty flawless moral life. And it sounds, you know, like I'm getting into sentimental territory. And I try not to. I try to point out when he made mistakes, too. But there's something about his moral example that's still very powerful, and even all the more so, I would say, in a pretty tough time for our politics today.
Ted Widmer is the author of the new book, Lincoln on the Verge, 13 Days to Washington. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Ted, thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on our program.
Thanks, Joe. Wonderful questions. I really enjoyed it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Lincoln on the Verge, 13 Days to Washington. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.